Billy. I'll do some sync claps now. You don't need to do sync claps because obviously you haven't got a video to sync with the audio.
Right. But sounds good.
So, welcome back, everyone, to the Optimized Podcast. We're optimizing for all the current music affairs and sharing it with you. Today, we are obviously joined with Josh, the co-host, and then a very special guest, Seth Rosenblum. So, how are you doing, you know? How's your week been?
I'm doing pretty well, all things considered. I mean, it's been a strange spring and summer with COVID-19 yeah. and everything, but all things considered, doing pretty well.
Brilliant. So, would you like to explain who you are, what you do, where you're based, and all that stuff?
Sure. So, I'm a blues guitar player and singer, and I'm based right outside of Boston, Massachusetts. Tour really all over, although 2020, no touring whatsoever.
Yeah, of course.
But looking forward to getting back at it, hopefully sometime next year.
Brilliant. So we have, I think, 8 questions. How are you? Five questions,
yeah, I've got
Josh.
Five.
Yeah, I've got 4. So that's 9.
Oh, excellent. Never mind. Sounds good.
So let's get into this. Josh, if you'd like to ask the first question, just start
yeah,
off with
sure.
yours.
So, when and what age did you start playing guitar?
So that's kind of a tricky question because I started really playing guitar at about 11. I actually saw the movie School of Rock, and I saw it in theaters at 11, and that that made me want to start really playing guitar. I had always had a curiosity and fascination with guitar, had kind of had ones around the house, really dating back to the time I was 2 or so, and I actually grew up playing classical violin, so I already had about seven, eight years of violin under my belt. I started around, I guess, 3, 4, 5, sometime in there, so I had started playing music at a very early age.
Okay, do you have music running in your family?
Yeah, so my parents actually met in music school, and my dad, they were both violinists, and my dad was a performing musician. That's what he did as a career, so I had that definitely in the family, and I think that did help make, when it got to later on and music was more of a career choice, made that more of an easy path to go down. Never easy, but just easier. I know there's often a lot of pushback from parents or things like that.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't have that.
Well, I can imagine how supportive your parents would be when, I guess, you decided you want to play music and stuff. Were you just like brought up on it, I guess?
More or less, yeah. So my dad was a classical violinist, so I was hearing all that.
Yeah.
Always heard him practicing and went to, you know, a lot of Boston Symphony, Boston Pops, Boston Ballet performances. And then my mom had grown up in Michigan in the 50s and 60s, and she was a huge Beatles fan. Actually saw the Beatles on their first U.S. tour. Then she was a big Motown fan, so I heard a lot of, you know, everything from the Temptations to Aretha Franklin to James Brown at a pretty early age. So was getting both sides of it there and really, really was exposed to a pretty wide range of stuff early on.
Oh, that's good. That's great. It's always better to start off with, I guess, music in the blood as well as just kind of being surrounded by it, because it's easier to start and you're really encouraged if you obviously have all that around you as a young age. But so just go ahead, ask an S one, Josh.
Okay, so what are your favorite amp and pedals for your style?
That's a tough question. So I'll go with what I currently use. So
we include guitar as well.
So yeah. I'll give kind of the whole rundown. Let's start with amps. Nice. So my main amp when I'm touring is usually my 2-Rock Bloomfield Drive.
Yeah.
100 watt head. Wow. Awesome amp, just can cover so much sonic territory. And usually run that into a string driver 410 cab. I've been long time fan of Fender Super Reverbs, but they are just so loud and so much amp, where even though the 2-Rock is higher wattage, I do find that with the master volume, I can get it to break up and get it where I want it at way lower volumes where sound guys aren't going crazy just with the levels. So that, and I often actually pair it with a second amp, or for smaller gigs, I've got a Victory V40 Deluxe Combo, which is a fantastic amp, kind of covers all the Fender territory, and I love that too. So those are the two main amps. I have some vintage Fenders around, but they really don't see the stage all that much. Mm-hmm. I just find that the 2-Rock and Victory stuff is so reliable and really covers all the bases I need. Then for pedals, I like so many different pedals, it's hard to kind of key in on certain
main
ones.
Main three then or something.
So the stuff that hasn't left my board in a while, I always like some sort of chorus pedal, and the best one I've found is the Thorpe Deep Ogden. Really awesome pedal, and it just kind of does that really lush, nice chorus that goes in between almost a Leslie sound and a chorus, where if you're playing a slow blues, it's great for the chords, but then it also works if you want to get a little out there and solo with it. It won't totally go crazy on single notes either. So that's been a mainstay on the board. And then with overdrives, there are so many. I mean, I love the King Tone Soloist. The just got a chance to try the Cornerstone Gladio and have one of those coming, and that's great. The Mythos Golden Fleece Fuzz is often on there. The Sokola 6. Then right now the only thing I've had plugged in up here is the Origin Revival Trem, so I like that. I like the jam pedals stuff, so it's the kind of thing where I'll switch different pedals on and off depending what's even in the set list of songs and also what amp I'm using. The Victory is much more of a pedal platform where I run it pretty clean, and the 2-Rock already has a bit more gain going on. So it's just different things for different purposes. And then I always like some kind of delay on there, just especially playing in a trio format. Helps fill out the sound and really just add some depth.
Yeah, yeah.
Guitar-wise, I've got my 56 Strat, which is always my number one. And then kind of a selection of other Strats and Tellys, mostly from LSL, and then also a builder down in Nashville, Jeff Sen. So I've got one of his Tellys that's fantastic. So, you know, the Strat, when I can have that, that ends up staying on stage 90% of the time. But I definitely mix some other things in as well.
So not much of a humbucker user, I guess.
I have one guitar that has humbuckers, and then my LSL Tele has a humbucker in the neck, but I actually have that to where it's normally split, so I don't even use that much. Not much of a humbucker guy. Even in kind of the Gibson territory, I tend to prefer P90s. Like, I've been fortunate to play some original, you know, 1958, 59, 60 Les Paul Bursts.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
I've generally preferred like 53, 54 gold tops with the P90s. And there's nothing wrong with the Burst. It's just that for what I like and how I like a guitar to react, single coils and P90s seem to breathe more and just open up.
Definitely, yeah.
Obviously, they have their problems in certain rooms in terms of hum, but I don't find that to be a huge detriment or a huge factor.
I'm a big humbucker guy. I don't know. I feel like Strats are, obviously, love a good Strat. You know, who doesn't love a good Strat? But it's just kind of to do with the how hot the signal is. So I just feel like strats are a lot quieter, and that's not kind of the stuff I want to do, if you know what I mean. So I'm kind of going for that type of, I would say Eric Johnson, but I'm going more towards Joe Bonamassa back in like 2007 to 2014, that like two rock Marshall Silver Jubilee, I think it was, Category 5.
He's a couple
and then
of Fenders
Dumble.
As well, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, no, he doesn't use any Fenders anymore. No, that's his
I
new rig.
He
uses the Tweed amps.
Oh, okay.
But before, back when he had that really lush, modern Eric Johnson sound, that's what I'm trying to go for. So I feel like humbuckers are just better for that, because I'm not trying to go for a really raw tone, if you know what I mean. But yeah, so I guess I have another question about Joe Bonamassa, but you just ask yours, Josh, because...
You sure?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll get carried away.
Have you got any advice on how to, let's say, go out and gig, how you do, or like growing yourself within the music industry?
That's a tough one. I mean, I feel like right now in 2020, obviously, everything's on pause. And
I guess for a normal year, then.
It does also bring up what the gigging scene is going to look like on the other side of this, and how many local venues, especially here in the States, are going to be left standing. Because I think when I talk with musicians kind of half a generation to a generation older than myself, I mean, I'm 28. Even by the time I was kind of coming up as a late in my teens, you know, 16, 17, 18, there were fewer and fewer gigs around than there were in the 80s, the 90s, even the early 2000s, of just, first of all, bars and clubs cracking down on anyone under 21 or 18 or whatever the number is being in there, but also just kind of the public consumption of live music, I think has changed considerably. So, you know, when I was 17, 18, I was really fortunate to kind of just start taking any gig that popped up. Not everything was in the styles I like to play, but it was just beneficial to get out there and play with other musicians. So I think the first step is just doing some of that and taking every gig that's available, whether it's the perfect gig or not. I mean, there's always kind of this, I've heard this mentioned a few places, rule of three with gigs, where you have three factors, and if it meets two of them, you should definitely take the gig. Number one is the music. Do you like and enjoy the music? Number two is the money. Does it pay well? And at first, honestly, that's almost an afterthought. And then number three is the hang, or the people you're playing with, fun to be around and good. So, you know, I'd say if any gig meets two of those, go take it. And, you know, you'll just benefit so much even from a gig that isn't perfect, in terms of developing your musicianship, being able to see what you can add to a situation that might not be the ideal one. Then in terms of building a solo career, that's a whole different thing. I started gigging and singing and doing the whole frontman thing under my own name around 2016. And it was just booking a couple gigs and working as hard as possible just to get a venue or a promoter to take a chance on me. And then from there, recording an EP, and a lot of that is just putting one foot in front of the other and taking baby steps. And before you know it, stuff is really piling on top of each other, and you're touring and doing all that. But I don't have a really good answer on how to do that, aside from be relentless in terms of booking gigs and seeking out opportunities, and really focus on getting the music and the product you're putting in front of people where you want that.
So on about you gigging, so is there any like big performances or shows that you have coming up that you'd like, I guess, to plug in into this podcast, but I guess obviously 2020 and COVID and stuff like
that. Yeah, I have absolutely zero on my schedule. I just did a live stream show about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. But aside from that, I think the next tour dates on my schedule are looking to be either March or April. It's just the next time that it's possible. I mean, I'm hoping to do a UK and Europe tour in the summer of next year.
What part of the UK?
Hopefully all over. I mean, I was over in December for a very limited kind of two-date thing. I was up in Edinburgh and then down in Broadstairs, just as kind of a get-in-the-door first time over there. So I'm hoping to do a pretty extensive UK tour, if it's possible, June or July 2021.
That'd be great. We could come and see you perform.
Yeah, really hoping to get over again. I love it. Love it over there.
Yeah, I guess the music scene down in London as well is pretty unreal with the opportunities there in London. But yeah, so go on. What were we going to say then?
Yeah. Are you going to say anything? No, I think it's just it's a very strange year in terms of everything, and even planning for next year. It's just trying to get a sense of if, as a U.S. citizen, if I'll even be able to get into the U.K., get into Europe and some of that. It's That's just true. The logistics have been made really, really difficult right now.
Yeah, I can understand that. I'd love to, you know, COVID has just completely wrecked so many lives. Mm-hmm.
2020 is basically cancelled.
Yeah, like all plans you had in 2020 essentially cancelled in summertime anyway.
Yeah, it wiped out pretty much everything after early March. I was, I guess, fortunate in the sense that I had a pretty busy schedule from November, December through the end of February. So I got a lot of touring in early 2020.
Before everything hit, yeah.
Right, but then everything, you know, any chance of any of the summer festivals, everything like that just got wiped out. It's pushed the next album back. All of that has just, it's definitely affected every part of life.
Yeah. Go on, Josh, that's the next one if you have another.
I've got two more, I think. All right. So, obviously, we talked a bit about your guitars. So, what's the first guitar that you fell in love with?
I've never been all that sentimental with guitars. I mean, even from starting out, I'd get a guitar, and when I'd see something else I liked, I was always kind of a gear trader and stuff, so I'd trade a guitar in. The only guitar I really have a super, super strong connection with, where it will never go anywhere else, is my 56 Strat. I had been looking for an older Strat. I was leaning 60s rosewood board for a long time, and I got pretty close to buying a couple of them, and then there was something that just didn't feel right. And then this one, I was actually in a shop to try an amp out, and saw a super beaten up Strat up at the top of the wall. And as soon as I played the first couple notes, I knew I had to have this Strat. And for me, I'm not saying it's the best Strat out there, but for me it is. I haven't played another that I've wanted more or could really compare. So that's the only one where I am pretty careful with that one, just less in the sense of anything happening to it from a financial reason, and more from a, I know I could never find a replacement for it.
Is it a real 56 Strat?
It's a real 56. Yeah.
Oh, I like, because I was thinking it was a reissue the entire time.
Oh, no. It's a real, I think the neck date is like December 56. So it's a late 56, kind of has the characteristics of a 57.
I mean, I've played reissues. I've always wanted to play like a real 50s or a real 60s. It's just
there's something about this one, and it's had a I think a pretty active life. I mean, there's actually a Strat buttonhole in the lower horn where it was owned by a lefty at one point. All the tuners are replacements. There's some body wear, obviously, to the point where there's no way I could afford a mint condition 56 or 57, but it's very much a player's guitar, where it's not something where a collector's really even going to be interested in it, because there are enough issues with it, but it's perfect for a player.
I guess those marks on the Strat actually do make it, like, it gives its own personality and stuff, you know what I mean?
For sure, it definitely feels worn in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, that's, like, 64 years old.
Yeah, it's got some history. It's got, I mean, I've owned it now for about 2.5 years, two and a half years or so. I got it right before I was doing my last record, so it made it on there, but... yeah, it's a fantastic guitar.
I can imagine. Right, go on, Josh. Wow. That's the next one.
Okay, so who is your biggest inspiration?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I might have to give a top three on this. I mean,
everyone's given a top three, because it's just so it's such a hard question. Isn't
it's a really hard question.
You just can't.
Ooh,
when
question.
If I had to pick one, it would be B.B. King, just because so much.
Yeah,
comes from there, and when I think of blues,
I can see that in your playing,
hand in hand with B.B. King.
How are you playing?
And I mean, some of the records, Live at the Regal, Blues on Top, a lot of those records. Just, I've always loved a slow blues above and beyond anything else, and just so much the master of singing and playing slow blues. Guitar wise, Stevie Ray Vaughan. The Live at the Elma Combo record, like that, in terms of Strat driven blues, that version, Texas Flood, is far and away, to me, the best live slow blues performance, maybe blues performance ever. And I'll give a kind of off the wall third one. And this is not top three for guitar. This would go more just as a blues influence vocally, Bobby Bland.
Yeah.
So on a lot of those B.B. King records, had kind of a soul R&B career too, but to me, probably the best male blues vocalist ever. Just so silky smooth. You know, when I'm listening to blues vocals, it's Bobby Bland and Aretha Franklin. Those are the two at the top. If we're going with the third guitar influence, it gets then it gets pretty tough. There are kind of a lot up there. Like B.B. and Stevie Ray Vaughan are way, way up there. And then, you know, Clapton, huge influence.
Oh, yeah.
Elmore James. For more modern players like Derek Trucks, I actually first heard... Joe Bonamassa when I was like 12 or 13. So he was a huge, huge influence in really kind of putting me on the path of playing blues, because I was playing rock, hard rock, metal, shred, all that stuff, and was way more into that at that point.
Joe Bonamassa is definitely my biggest influence, I'd say. So I guess on to Joe Bonamassa. So I'm pretty sure he follows you on Instagram, doesn't he?
I believe so. I'm not honestly that sure.
So, how did that happen? What is your relationship with him? Do you know what I mean? Like, are you friends with him or something?
I've met Joe kind of just in passing a couple times, but have a lot of mutual friends. Mostly, I'd say the biggest one I could point to, Josh Smith, who produced my last record, and I've spent a lot of time with Josh. So, yeah, a lot of mutual friends, Josh, and you know, Kirk Fletcher too, and some of those guys.
Yeah.
Wow, you've hanged out with you've hanged out with some pretty big shots. You know, that's great. That's great to know, because like I've always thought, because you always see your heroes and stuff as unreachable people. You never meet them, never talk to them at all. Or, you know, you never have any contact with them and stuff. Because that's how it's like with, like, you know, I guess for Josh, like John Mayer and stuff, like when is the chance that you're going to meet him and talk to him? You know what I mean?
It's like, funny because there is that, you know, I think especially with pop stars or movie stars, very inaccessible thing. But I think, you know, the guitar community, especially in recent years with Instagram, YouTube, and the internet in general, has just become so much smaller, where even a lot of the guys that are so much at the top of the game and kind of looked at as some of those guitar heroes, I think a lot of them at the end of the day are still just guitar geeks who want to talk guitars, see new guitar players and stuff like that.
That's,
I mean, I know. Do you want to go?
No, go ahead.
Oh. I mean, I nearly got to meet him. Like,
John Mayer's on about involved, now.
Yeah. My dad was involved in sort of travel for him or for his band and stuff. So it was so close to meeting him, but I was just amazed that I was like in the same room as him. It's like,
it gets to that stage though, when you just love a guitar hero so much to the point you're just grateful that they even replied to your comment on Instagram or something, you know?
I mean, I remember probably the time I was more starstruck than any other. I was 15 or 16. And at that point, I was playing blues, but not nearly as much as now. And at that point, by far, my biggest influence was John Petrucci of Dream Theater. And got a chance to meet him. And it was totally like a, wow, is this actually happening kind of moment.
What was that like? Like, what did you talk to him?
Yeah, like, it was sort of in passing backstage at a Dream Theater concert, and I remember getting, at that point I was playing I think Music Man John Petrucci signature model, and he signed, I brought the back plate from the guitar and he signed it, and I actually still have that up on the wall in my childhood bedroom. So that was a really cool moment when I was still, you know, decently young.
Damn, I can that's so unreal.
I'd love to buy a Strat and John Mayer signs it or something like that. I'd be like,
you can tell he likes John Mayer a lot due to the cardboard cutout in the background. You're probably really freaked out about that when you first won on call. You're like, what the hell are we getting? What am I getting myself into?
He's a great songwriter and guitar player.
Yeah. But I'm just, it's amazing to know, because like, because at the end of the day, they are just guitar players just like us, you know?
Yeah.
They don't, like, for, I think more Joe Bonamassa and Eric Johnson and all those type of people, like, they that haven't got extreme major fame, like millions and millions of listeners a month, but they are still like a guitar hero, like a pretty big shot.
They're still out there.
Yeah, exactly. And like, because at the end of the day, those type of people are just guitar players. So it's not like they, because I feel like pop stars would be very rude if you were going to meet them, mainly because they just haven't got the time. You know what I mean? Like, because I can imagine being a pop star is very time consuming, but there you go. But I'm just amazed on your connection. So what do you mean Josh Smith, like, produced your record? So like, what actually happened? Because I'm a bit confused.
So I've known Josh since, I think we were on the same kind of festival in early 2017. Met then, and like with a lot of those festivals, it ends up just hanging out, talking, so got to know him a bit. And Josh has an awesome studio at his house in LA, and was just kind of finishing, I think, building it at that point. So had talked some about it, and when it got to the point of doing my first full-length record, I knew I wanted a producer to work with that I did not want to self-produce, just from the standpoint of, first of all, being able to myself focus just on the guitar playing and singing, and also from the perspective of not having a ton of experience in studio. Like, so many of the sessions I've done are remote sessions where someone sends me a track and I play on it from my house. I just wanted someone there whose ears I trusted, who could really help with the arrangements and then also help with making sure everything with the drums, bass, keys, everything was coming together how we wanted. So ended up doing it in two sets of sessions, flew out to LA and did it at Josh's studio. He's done a lot of producing in recent years and obviously a monster guitar player and is known for that, but just as much on the production side. Just great ears and great sense of really building a song and doing all that. So it was awesome working with him on it.
Wow, I can imagine. What was the studio like? Like, it was just like in your like your dream studio, I guess, because
it's
from all the success.
You know, I've been in different studios, and his is very much a home studio. It's in a space out the back of his house, so it's not the biggest or most glamorous studio in the world, but it's got everything that you would need to do a blues record, blues guitar record. And he's got great mics, great preamps, and doing what he does, especially knows how to get awesome guitar tone, also great drum tone. So
yeah,
it made it really easy because he did all the hiring of musicians, and it was really, for me, I was able to just show up and worry about playing and singing as well as I could on it.
Yeah, I watched your live stream. I think it was 8th of August, wasn't it?
Yep,
I'm pretty
sounds
sure, something
right.
Like that.
Yep.
And your playing is unbelievable. You play like you're so great on the guitar.
Well,
I just
thank you.
I want to appreciate that because, I mean, I know it's a lot different to play live than in your bedroom, you know. So big respect there. But wouldn't it? There was no one there, wasn't there?
There was no one there. Just kind of the crew that was filming and doing everything for the show. So a little bit of applause and stuff from them. But yeah, it was definitely a readjustment after, you know, 5 months of playing at home. It was just also getting used to the intensity of playing live again, because it's so much different how much you're digging in on a lot of the bends and how hard you're going with the vibrato, where I definitely felt a little out of shape in terms of live performing, but you know, it comes back pretty quick.
Yeah. So I guess you are in love with the blues, clearly. So where did that love like come from and start?
So much of the music I listened to when I was pretty young definitely derived from the blues and had relation to it, whether that's some of the Motown stuff or even early Beatles. But it was really, I was either 12 or 13, it was like 2005, and I really wanted to go to a Dream Theater show here in Boston. And my mom said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll take you to that if you go to any show that I choose. And at that point, my parents were trying to steer me away from the kind of hard rock and more towards, you know, blues, jazz, stuff that I think they'd prefer to listen to. And she found a listing of an up-and-coming blues guitar player in the local paper. And it was at like a 200-person jazz club. And I was not all that excited to be going to it. And it ended up being Joe Bonamassa when he was playing clubs. So I mean, it was a life-changing kind of thing. I remember showing up at that point. I think he had like just a Marshall half stack in there. I mean, it was a small club. And it was to this day probably one of the best shows I've ever seen. He was still doing, you know, power trio. And I remember he ended the night with Jeff Beck Band Blues Deluxe.
And
that pretty much put me on the path to thinking blues was cool to play. And over time, it just ended up feeling like the most authentic thing for me to play, much more than any of the kind of rock or shred stuff.
I sometimes I do wish that the big heroes that we have now aren't as big as they are, just because of the how easy and accessible it would be to go to one of their gigs. Do you know what I mean? So, like, obviously, it's going to be... tickets are going to start selling out pretty quickly if you try to get a concert with John Mayer, for example, but...
I mean, the tickets of John Mayer sold out in, like, 2 minutes. And we stayed up till midnight. We just have to click as they come.
Well, and it's I guess mental. The proof of it is you never really know who the next up-and-comer is. Because
exactly,
I
yeah.
think the
yeah.
next time I saw Joe after that, he was playing in like a 1,400-seater. So, you know, stuff can elevate pretty quickly.
Yeah, and then you can... But the thing is, with them not being big, is they won't come to your country. So, because obviously he's in... America, and we're over in Wales, and that in the UK, and that can't really happen if he's not that big of a deal. However, he was going to be coming to Wales, Cardiff, I think he was, Motorpoint Arena, for those of you in Wales who know where that is. I was going to watch him live on May the 2nd or something, and obviously that got cancelled, and I was so gutted. I really wanted to see him. And it got cancelled from COVID. So that's probably my biggest loss from COVID, not being able to see Joe on a massive for the first time. Because now over lockdown, I've fallen in love with him and his playing. It's just unbelievable. You know, he's just such a big inspiration. But yeah, less on to me and more on to asking you some questions, because this is your interview, not mine. But so I think this is the last question. So this is a big thing for our podcast, because we ask it to every single person we've interviewed.
I know what this is.
So, do you know what you're not tone wood is, I assume?
Like the woods to build guitars?
The wood changes the tone, and yeah, mahogany's absolutely. Bad and whatever. Do you think it's real?
Yes, 100%.
All right.
Yes.
Without a doubt. I mean... I've heard Definitely. All the arguments of, oh, you can build a guitar out of Legos and it'll still sound the same because it all comes down to the pickups. But I think that if you play enough guitars, you can't help but think it's a large factor in what a guitar sounds like. Because my rule of thumb for what makes a good sounding guitar, and this is... talking electric guitars, because acoustics, tone wood matters just that much more. Yeah. With electric guitars, I've never played a great electric guitar that didn't also sound and feel great unplugged.
Yeah.
Usually one that feels and sounds great unplugged sounds great plugged in. If it doesn't sound and feel great unplugged, it usually also doesn't feel or sound great plugged in. I think there's such a connection to it. And I definitely have my preferences. Some of those have changed over time. I used to be really in the camp of like Alder with a maple neck and rosewood board for a Strat, kind of the 60s thing. I've definitely drifted more towards the maple neck. Still off an Alder body, and for Tellies, I've gone much more towards the rosewood board thing. My general feeling on the... Because I think one of the most common things with guitars is maple board or rosewood board. To me, the maple board always tends to have a bit more bite and a little more sizzle, and then putting a rosewood board, it's like 8% of the tone. It's not a huge part of it, but it
does
just...
difference.
It's that difference, and the rosewood tends to like round off the top end, which I really like that on Tele now, because I can still be aggressive with it, but it's not going to take your head off. And with a Strat... Yeah. There are other things I do to kind of prevent that, where I like the maple board, but for instance, I always have the bridge pickup wired to the lower tone knob so that I can roll that just down to 6 or 7 and take some of that top end sizzle off.
That is the thing of single coils,
And that does the same kind of thing of just, I like a lot of top end, but I never want it to where it kind of hurts to listen to. So that that helps to make sure that it's pleasant still.
Yeah, that's another reason why I kind of prefer humbuckers, though, just because of how it hasn't got incredible high end, you know what I mean? So it's just a little bit rolled off.
Very true.
I have a Les Paul with all mahogany, and I mean, I'm a Les Paul guy, I guess, so obviously I'm going to be biased towards humbuckers, but like, it's just something to do with the single coil. It's just that little bit too high. Like, obviously you can dial that back in EQ and stuff in the amp, but it's just, what if you do want that headroom? Do you know what I mean? So like, what if you do want that? If you want to dial back the presence to get rid of some of the high end, you know, you could just, but you do want the headroom of the adding the presence. It's just a thing that I don't know.
It's a different sort of setup for sure. I mean, I like single coils for some of the same reasons. I find that, especially in certain situations, humbuckers can sometimes get lost in the mix because there is more compression, where single coils, like with a Tele bridge pickup, you're never going to get buried. It's always going to jump out, and somewhat the same with like a Strat bridge pickup. And there's just something when I play with humbuckers, I feel like I'm having to over accentuate some of the things that I'm doing to get them to really pop out because of that added compression, where single coils let me very naturally play and it all comes through. But that's so dependent on the player and how your touch matches up to the guitar. And I do think that's why some people, their touch really works better with humbuckers, and others with single coils.
Oh. What you on about with the touch of the guitar? Where did you learn your amazing vibrato?
Honestly, 90% of that comes from starting on violin at a young age. And just even though it's a different motion, it was just getting the ability to hear good vibrato and really get a sense of that. Because that's so important playing a classical string instrument. And then it was, I think, just listening to guitar players with great vibratos. You know, there are so many out there. Stevie Ray, B.B. King, Albert King. And working on developing my own thing with that on the guitar. But I credit a lot of that to playing violin.
Well, then, I think that's about all we have time for, but that was I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Well,
to be
thank
honest,
you
that
so
that was
much for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on, because you know we are a small channel, so it's very grateful for you coming on. I've certainly enjoyed it, and I know Josh has too, and more importantly, our followers. If you want to see more of Seth, you can follow him at it is at Seth Rosenblum, isn't it?
On Instagram or my website is just SethRosenblum.com.
And I'll link that down below in the description so you can check him out if you like. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, then please subscribe, like, comment, all that good stuff. Listen to us on Spotify if you want that, Optimized Podcast. And thank you everyone for tuning in, and we will see you on the next one. Goodbye. Thanks for coming on, Seth.
Thank you.